I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Mackinder, International Relations, our discussion of Russia, the Russian Federation. What is to be done? In the 21st century, it is not the Russia of the Soviet era. It is not the Russia of the end of the Cold War or a transition into a Western-style democracy. It is a Russia that has headlines that match what's going on in the West, but with different interpretations. For example, Moscow Times. Russia reports record COVID deaths for the fifth straight day. Moscow Times. Moscow restaurants struggle to stay afloat under new coronavirus restrictions. Moscow Times. Former French Prime Minister François Fillon joins Russian oil company board. Moscow Times. Celebrates summer with whipped brydza and tomatoes. Brydza and tomatoes. That's Moscow Times. That's Russia Today. You do not see, and I will mention, that Vladimir Putin is completely in charge except for this subhead. Putin, the man with all the answers. Putin's annual call-in is meant to show everyday Russians that there is no problem in the country that escapes his all-compassing vision. Professor, a very good evening to you. That last is my departure point. Vladimir Putin is the benevolent philosopher king of Plato's imagination. I understand we can also use the term tyrant and dictator, but I prefer philosopher king. He's in the czarist role, he's in the Kremlin, and he commands his lieutenants, his dukes, his aristocracy of work. However, here's my observation about how we got to this. Plato reminded us 2,500 years ago that democracy is not useful. Why? Because democracy depends upon the votes of people who are not well-informed and only think short-term. Two, democracy tends to favor demagogues, not good leaders, demagogues. And three, and this is critical, democracy gives way too much to freedom and not enough to discipline, leading to anarchy, disorder, despair, and dictatorship. So, Vladimir Putin has listened to this, and his counselors listen to this, and while they use the trappings of democracy, he runs for re-election every once in a while, he has no difficulty removing any limitations to his leadership, and we believe now that he has no end date for his presidency of Russia. So, while he is sanctioned routinely by the United States and other virtue signalers in the European Union, he runs an empire that is ambitious, that is aggressive, that is well-armed, and right now its mission is to tuck up its borders. The Russian Federation wants to resemble the once-upon-a-time Russian Empire. Therefore, I am content to take Russia for what it is, not a democracy, not a republic, nothing to do with the Constitution, but a strong man who is sitting in for the Tsar and acting like Plato's philosopher king. Good evening to you, Professor.
Good evening, sir. Well, I think this is a very provocative approach, but of course, Russia is unique in unto herself, and I just make a couple of quick points. First, Plato's Republic is basically a reaction to the Peloponnesian War and to the belief that democracy is what led. It was the death of Pericles and the rise of the masses without leadership that led to the total disaster.
Let me do a couple of details, Professor. Plato was born, we think, 428-427 B.C., and he was born into an Athens that was ripped not only by war, but by pandemic, by plague, and Pericles was the leader. There were harsh lessons for the people of Athens all during Plato's childhood. And when he founded the Academy in 386 BCE, he had in mind that he had to prepare the next generation not to make the mistakes of the one he was born into. Please continue, Professor.
I think that's right. I was going to say, though, that your characterization of Putin, I think, is rather good. But I would make two points. First, Putin does not use ta- talented associates. If you think of the late Tsarist period, you had these towering figures like Pyotr Stolypin and Count Witte and so forth. He had very, very good advisors, and they actually were moving Russia forward, both economically and socially, but also militarily. It was Witte, really, who created the whole eastern projection of Russia. And I think that Putin has made the mistake of failing to understand that Russia cannot be ruled centrally. The Tsar was a symbolic unifier, but the actual administration was done oblast by oblast, or gubernia by gubernia, by governors. And they had a great deal of autonomy, and that was one of the things that kept the place from becoming brittle. I don't think that Putin understands this. He is over-centralizing. He no longer allows governors to be elected. He insists on appointing them. The other point is that although he's a benevolent dictator, according to your definition, Putin is deeply dissatisfied. This is a man who considers that the end of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of recent history, and he is disturbed by the way that Russian sway has ceased to be total, particularly along the southern borders, all the way from Moldavia to Ukraine, to the Black Sea, and particularly look at the Caspian Sea. That used to be a Russian lake, with the exception of a little Iranian presence in the south. Now the whole thing is basically included in Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan and Azerbaijan, and all that Russia has is the passage of the Volga into the northern Caspian, and there are several other navies there. This is extremely disconcerting, because it was only in 1772 that Catherine the Great waged the great war with Turkey that finally got Russia into that whole area, even the Black Sea. So I think that Putin is very concerned to do what is impossible, which is to reconstruct the old Soviet sphere of influence.
In reconstructing the Soviet sphere of influence, however, he's playing a game that Russia's won for, can we say, 1,000 years? We'll do the legend of 1,000 years. And I want to
see. That's legend, yes.
I want to seize on one part of that legend, which is Ukraine. Ukraine represents the birthplace of Russia. Kiev is the holy city that Russia admires a great deal. Ukraine is right now fragmented by Russian actions. Crimea, a piece of Donbass. Russia has a foothold in Donbass.
Foothold in Donetsk and Lugansk.
And then there's Western Ukraine. Ukraine, according to Vladimir Putin's most recent remarks, obeys Western leaders. That's how it's put in Russian terms. Western leaders.
Yes.
In other words, Ukraine has become a colony of the United States and NATO. That is not in Russia's interests, and the Russian people do not support that. Also, Crimea is Russia's warm water port. It must control it. This legal talk about when did Russia pass Ukraine, Crimea to Ukraine, and is Ukraine part of Russia because the Soviets broke up and Ukraine went a separate way, that doesn't acknowledge the fact that as a philosopher king in Moscow, Putin must hold on to the Black Sea entrance, and he must subdue Ukraine and bring it back under his fold, or he's failed. So, Professor, the United States and NATO's interference in Ukraine is deliberately provocative if you understand Russian history, and we do.
Well, I think that's correct, and I wish that we would decide what our policy goals were for Ukraine, because we're now sending very mixed signals. It's become clear that Biden's summit with Putin, not surprisingly, led Putin to see us, the West, as weak. So he's now trying, as always, to split up NATO. And as you mentioned, he's got the French and the Germans in particular trying to balance between the two. On the other hand, he is not in a position militarily to subdue Ukraine without an entirely unacceptable cost. Crimea, it's very hard to see how Ukraine is going to get Crimea, but Crimea, you're quite right about the importance of Sevastopol and so forth. I mean, this is her gateway to the Black Sea and then, of course, to the Mediterranean and to the Atlantic. But Ukraine is becoming increasingly strong and self-identified. And furthermore, the United States is talking out of both sides of her mouth. When Biden met Putin, he suspended our military aid, such as it is, to Ukraine, and he approved the Nord Stream pipeline, which is strategically a blow to Ukraine. On the other hand, in a couple of weeks, we're going to start Operation Sea Breeze in the Black Sea, which is going to involve 32 countries sailing around in what used to be a Russian lake, including Australia, South Korea, and Japan. And if we're trying to calm down the Russians, certainly that's not a way to do it. If, on the other hand, we're trying to abide by the Budapest Memorandum of 1994, Russia is in complete violation of that memorandum, which she signed. And we have to realize that what this means is that Putin doesn't, you can't make a binding agreement with him. So I see Ukraine and basically the southern border of Russia as being the neuralgic point, and it's a pretty big neuralgic point for Mr. Putin.
I want to turn to the U.S. next, Professor, because our response to Vladimir Putin's mission, which is to reassemble the Russian Empire, whether it's the Tsarist Russian Empire or the Soviet Russian Empire, it has borderlands near abroad that are critical to Russia's sense of security and prosperity. So when we come back, how has the United States responded these last years? And how is the Biden administration responding in order to either calm the waters or avoid a direct military conflict, which we both know would be an accident of history, but there it is. Professor H.J. Mackinder, International Relations, and I'm John Batchelor.